resisted this idea of coordinated bargaining. It's been something that we made a lot of progress on. Unfortunately, you probably are aware that there was a recent proxy fight on one of the big class ones, the Norfolk Southern. And that proxy fight was not only incredibly destructive and divisive in its own regard, in its own industry, it also created a huge problem where my own union and another of the unions under the Teamster umbrella split away and made a separate arrangement with the losing side of that proxy fight, thereby basically reigniting all of the old problems and all the old fears and distrust and stuff. So, you know, if there is a silver lining to that, it's that the employers are not any less determined to destroy everything. And since that's true and people know it, there's still a chance, especially with good hard work, that we will be able to do better on the solidified consolidated bargaining. So I want to get to where you all can ask me all kinds of questions, but I do know that there were a few things that were posed, and one of them had to do with high-speed rail. And it's a question in Washington State, and it's a question in various other parts of the country. So we are not all exclusively of one mind in this regard in the industry, but Railroad Workers United, our general position is it's the same one that we have with regard to all kinds of other technology, which is that, you know, give us good tools, give us the best tools that you can provide, but don't try to substitute experimental processes and things of that sort for trained, skilled crews. And in the case of high-speed rail in particular, the problem is that we again and again find ourselves in a situation where we have to say this particular model is great technology, wrong application. Wrong application meaning that it sucks all the money out of the room and it basically provides new options for affluent people who already have options, this city to this city, whatever, leaving all of the places that are not connected out twisting in the wind. So, and there are some exceptions, but generally speaking, the projects that are currently being discussed and promoted by the industry and by the Biden administration and others are not real solutions to the problems that we have that cry out for a real solution. So, and it can be discussed in, you know, case-by-case basis. But generally speaking, and you all, you know, being neighbors to California, presumably are somewhat familiar with the disastrous more than a decade of fooling around that is jockeying between, as one of the other folks was saying, you know, making sure that they get their piece of the pie, even if that means ruining the pie altogether. And their whole conception that these things have to be done in a way to, as I said, basically they're basically vanity projects in a certain respect, where they're going to connect cities that are already connected. The version that we're fighting here in Maryland, near where I live, which is a maglev project, and maglev is actually some excellent technology, but they're basically going to just run roughshod over every in-between community, not stop there at all, ruin their environment, cause all kinds of destruction, and make it impossible to connect our unconnected communities. So we can talk more about high-speed rail if you all want to talk about that. You all know that a year ago we actually came very close in the industry to having a nationwide strike. Hasn't happened very much in the course of my years. We were only on strike twice, and I don't think in any case my particular part of the industry was not on strike, and it created a great deal of unhappiness, particularly amongst folks directing it at the Biden administration, because the Biden administration were the ones that denied us that right. And the real activating part of that the real motivating part of that strike was the industry's insistence that they basically not provide any kinds of realistic options for. So there's three things you really don't want to have with a train crew. You don't want to have somebody who's sick on the train, running the train. You don't want to have them where they really need to be somewhere else, you know, because of a family matter or something like that, or because they're exhausted. And the problem is with the industry situation the way it is now, all of those things take place all the time. And probably the only reason why we don't have a great deal more in the way of catastrophes and things is because, first of all, our people are actually pretty good at their jobs, number one, and they do care, and they are professionals and whatnot, but they and there is technology as well, but these problems are essentially unresolved. They're somewhat better. You've read in the news that there have been certain deals in certain parts of the country, certain parts of the industry, but they still don't get at that, what I just said. So you don't want them on the train when they're sick, you don't want them on the train when they're exhausted, and you don't want them on the train when they really, really, really need to be somewhere else. I mean, it's just common sense. Normal people, all of us, we would have them say, that's just common sense. But when it's the government talking and the industry talking, all of a sudden common sense isn't, you know, one of the things. So now, very quickly, so that we can have this other conversation, I want to talk about public rail ownership. So the railroads are privately owned. They didn't start in, you know, paradoxically, you know, a lot of people don't know this, they didn't start as private-owned operations back 150, 160 years ago. But they have been primarily privately owned, and as a result of that, perhaps more, there's parallels in a lot of the other big industries. They've been in crisis over and over and over and over again. And when I say crisis, it's a combination of not just safe operating practices, but also its impact on economy. So that all of the people in the country, whether they're on the railroad or not, have a stake in the question of, you know, who's at the switch, in the old use of the language. There's actually a whole lot of railroad things in the language, but the fact that the, especially in the recent years, the corporate boards have been taken over by hedge funds, and one of my good friends and allies, who you all may or may not know, his name is Tom White. He's one of the main principal behind the Washington State group called the Climate Rail Alliance. Well, you know, one of the things that he says, he's got an excellent book, by the way, which I could recommend to you, is that they've figured out how to make money without running trains. Now, you could see how this works in some respects with respect to the fact that, you know, more and more what they want to run is longer and longer and heavier trains. And instead of running three trains, they run one train, which is super long, super heavy. The physical dynamics of which have never really actually been vetted, never really actually been tested. So we're constantly running into new problems in this way. This is a situation where it wasn't really possible in the past, but certain technological advances have made it possible, and so we're now dealing with that. So they don't want to run trains. They don't want to have crews on the trains. They're upfront about that. The industry will, you know, say, and of course you all know that, you know, we're, you know, actually very gratified that we now have some national protections on the question of crew size. Crew consists at least two trained, qualified, professional crew members on each train, which is better than the situation that we had, but it actually still has, as the president of my union has said in the recent time, holes in it big enough to drive a freight train through. The industry has said up front that this is crazy, that, and their position, and I have been in the legislature and heard them say this in public. They say that if you want to do the same safe best practice thing that we've done for, you know, 100 years or whatever like that, you have to prove that it is more safe. But if they want to do brand new things that nobody's ever done, like single person crews or you know, robots, then they have no responsibility to do any testing of those, any proof. They don't have to provide proof. The only proof you have to do is to keep it the way that it has been. And at least we have some nominal protection on this question now. So back to the public ownership thing. The industry is in such disarray. It doesn't provide service. It doesn't provide safety. The economic aspect of it, there are organizations that you would never think of as potentially allies of labor, like the big shippers and the farmers and the grain areas and things of that sort, that are being, you know, absolutely, you know, the terrible things are happening to them. And the railroads, because they essentially have a monopoly in this regard, there's certain kinds of service that they actually would rather those people go put all their stuff on trucks because they don't want to handle it. Because if they had to handle it, they'd have to have more employees. Anyway, short version of all this, and we could have a whole conversation about public ownership, is that we think for the first time in many years, a lot of people in the industry, a lot of the railroaders, understand that the private ownership hedge fund run operation is the problem and is only fixable through a stakeholder public ownership situation. Now, I should point out, for those that don't know this, that this may sound radical, but we've done this over and over again. In some cases, we haven't done it very well, but time of the First World War, the private operations were so bad that the government took over the railroads at that time. It was called the Plum Plan. Railroad Workers United is actually getting ready to release a white paper that details a lot of fabulous information. You all will want to read it. You all want to, you know, see this story. But even in our lifetimes, the bankruptcies of the big roads and the consolidated rail operations and things and it happened in the U.S. and in Canada. So this is it's always happening. Every generation, they get to the point where they put all of the American people at risk, both safety-wise and economic-wise, just so that they can do stock buybacks and crazy other things of that sort. So I guess what I'll do is I'll turn it over to you all now, and I'll answer questions. And if I don't know the answer, I'll get you the answer.
Oh, there you go. That was a great introduction. Great.
Hey, Fritz, thank you for that. That was great. One thing I wanted to ask was, it's very weird that the actual ownership and the, you know, the profit is, you know, not nationalized. It's not going towards anything. It's not publicly get garnered. But yet the president has the ability to stop the union from going on strike. That seems like a pretty big contradiction. What's your take on that? Like, what's the view of you and then also the union?
Well, so this rolls up to the Railway Labor Act, which is the first really major piece of federal labor legislation, and it goes back to before the time of things like Social Security and the National Labor Relations Board and whatnot. And, you know, a lot of people think that, I mean, they'll say, you know, that the Railway Labor Act prevents us from striking, which is pretty much accurate. It's basically it's a formula, and it's like, if you jump over 25 hoops and whatnot, then you can strike, unless we decide to have a presidential emergency board or this or that or the other. And so it hamstrings us. It denies us some pretty basic, you know, generally in the population, I think, understood to, you know, the right to strike, you know, may be controversial. Maybe people don't like it, but they think that you have that right. You know, we theoretically have it, but it's really, really, really hard to get to the point where we use it. So I don't know if that answers your question. It's it will come as no surprise to you that we regard this as, you know, an unlevel playing field.
Yes.
You know.
Because it's just weird that I mean, a kind of classic case, though, that the federal government, the public entity, has this ability to direct labor, but it can't do the same thing for the actual ownership of the enterprise.
Yeah.
Well, of course, the executive could, the executive could do so, and that's actually, you know, part of what we're trying to do when we're trying to, I mean, my problem is I don't want people to just look at the Plum Plan in World War One and go, oh, well, that's an example, but that's, you know, a one-off, because it's not really a one-off. We've had other things, but the virtue of that one is that look, you people are not running the railroad, and it's, in this case, hurting the war effort or whatever, you know, whatnot. And one of the things about that is that in the aftermath, and I want to say it was 1923, I could be wrong, when they finally decided that it was time to, you know, decide whether we're going to keep doing this, have federal control of the railroads or not, an overwhelming majority of all the hundreds of thousands of railroad workers in their unions voted to support that move. In other words, overwhelmingly, it was the position of labor that the railroad should stay under federal control. And because they could see it, the record was pretty clear, actually. But, of course, propaganda being the way that it is, you know, the population as a whole in a lot of cases didn't see it the same way. And, unfortunately, they gave control back to the private owners, and we suffered as a result.
Okay. I'm really glad you're here. I am a writer for the Freedom Socialist newspaper, and I wrote two different articles already about the Railroad Workers United, which your members provided amazing history and analysis on. And I want to know afterwards if you're willing to be interviewed by me. Now, that's just getting the best out of the way. But we actually totally believe in nationalization of basic industries, but that does not mean it's turned over to people like Joe Biden, because that doesn't really help. Public ownership of the rails is essentially, it's like, think about this, rail for profit. How about healthcare for profit? How about food for profit? They're all ridiculous concepts. And what we're interested in, and my newspaper, The Freedom Socialist, is what is it we can do in addition to publicity, which is always good, because getting your voice out is always important. And I really appreciate this particular forum, because partly because they're from Spokane, which is a railway hub, even more than Seattle. For freight rail, Spokane is it. But as a rail person who travels when she can on passenger rail, if freight rail doesn't work, neither does passenger rail. So instead of getting to San Francisco rested and happy after whatever the ride was, we're supposed to drive or ride the bus. Anyway, so what is it? A, will you agree to be interviewed so I get back to you with more concrete questions? And two, all right, what are your solutions to the actual freight rail, which I mean the tracks and the cars? Can you explain, other than just, well, I wrote down federal control. We actually think that it might be a better idea to have workers control of those kinds of basic industries, because that means that it doesn't matter who's president. Okay, that's
well. So I would just say, first of all, of course, ready to be interviewed, or maybe I can find the best person in RWU, depending on what you're looking for such a thing, and that's generally true. What we try to do, and it's the thing that kind of makes us stand out from most of our other union colleagues, official union colleagues, is that they're deathly afraid. They would never speak to anybody in the media at all if they could figure out how to do it. And we think that's a death sentence for us, whatever. So then the, right. then the second thing on the quick character of the public ownership. Now, first of all, in a lot of the initial conversations we had in our internally, we actually used the N-word, nationalization.
Yeah.
We eventually decided that we would prefer generally not to use that because it kind of set the conversation off with a sort of a prejudice to it or something or other, because people associate that with things that happen in other countries and other situations and whatnot. And so we have chosen the public ownership idea. And there's actually an important parallel, which you would probably appreciate, that has to do with healthcare, which is that that I think at this point in the progressive world, that there's a consensus that we shouldn't all just hunker down in one particular, you know, like, for example, you know, Medicaid for all or single payer or blah, 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 that the that it's premature for us to specifically dictate exactly what the form would be. The important thing is to get at the stakeholder part. And I just learned today, for example, that I have now been appointed to a four-year position at the D.C. state level for a rail advisory board, which means that it's not even close to being what we need. But what it means is some of the unrepresented stakeholders are at the table. That's the point. Now, I mentioned Climate Rail Alliance earlier. The Climate Rail Alliance group has a pretty good idea that what they think is necessary is like the European model, where the state owns the base infrastructure and whatnot, and then private groups can run it. We don't generally agree with that. We think that perhaps, as you mean, in other words, that when we say we don't actually endorse federal control, we endorse public ownership, which is a stakeholder thing with public boards, ideally elected public boards. There's a fight right now that you all could be interested in that I'd encourage you, if you are such, if you're advocates of Amtrak, then you know that the Biden administration uncritically just forwarded the Republican nomination of Ron Bottori to the Amtrak board. The Amtrak board is the closest that we currently have in this country to a public board that's supposed to advocate for passenger rail. Ron Bottori is the enemy of all of that. And granted, they will tell you, oh, well, he has no choice because that's the way, you know, the law says no more than five members of the board can be from one party, and the Republicans get to nominate somebody, blah, blah. Well, whatever. That doesn't mean that he has to uncritically put forward a guy that they wouldn't even keep in the position of FRA administrator. So we would like to see a big public outcry against the nomination of Ron Bottori to the Amtrak board. Now, this is not, I mean, I'm not suggesting that this solves any problems, but what I would suggest to you is that if you want to engage in that and you want to get into that fight, it offers you the opportunity to talk about the Amtrak board and what kind of a board it should be and who it should represent and what it should be for and how it should be, you know, whatever. So by, you know, you'd get a twofer. Number one, you'd get an enemy of passenger rail and a, you know, a manager's manager out of the picture, and at the same time you'd have the opportunity to campaign and talk about what public stake in passenger rail should look like.
Thank you.
Really interesting stuff. Jackie, before you call on somebody else, I want to make a little comment on that. The I've recently been in contact with the Postal Workers Union, one of their people that's been helped us in the past, and they had a rally downtown. They also have this kind of public situation. They've got a postmaster general, and it's under somebody, you know, basically who's elected president. But the the leader of this country, Biden, has done nothing really to change the character of that thing away from what it was under Trump, which is just basically against public post offices.
Right.
It's astounding. So I think I'm for socialist planning, and I'm for nationalization. I like the term, but but there's got to be some sort of control over it. Can't just be, you know, let the Biden administration run it. That's for sure. So because it's deceitful. It claims to be on the side of the workers, but it isn't.
Yeah. Hi. I was curious if part of the argument for nationalizing could be related to national security after the events in East Palestine, Ohio, where basically an entire region's ecosystem was killed. Shouldn't it be considered a matter of national security, considering some of the materials that are being put on the railroads every day?
Well, I would say yes. Now, of course, the railroads, one of their responses, and it's, you know, it's disingenuous because it just is self-serving, but they claim the common carrier defense. A common carrier is basically one of the things about the way that the railroads are allowed to sort of operate as monopolies is that they're not supposed to be able to reject carrying whatever your goods are. And so therefore they'll say, well, as a common carrier, somebody wants to, you know, carry chlorine gas through your neighborhood, they have to do it. It's more complicated than that, but the main point is that whenever it's convenient for them to not move this and to move that, they do it, and it doesn't have anything to do with the question of whether it's a danger to the community. So to speak to your national security argument, obviously there's a, I mean, I'm uncomfortable with that because one of the things that we saw in those amongst us who actually fought against bomb trains, the big, you know, extended volatile oil trains, is that the national security argument was used to argue why communities were not allowed to have any information about what was going through their neighborhood, or you know, whether they might be able to take some kind of action to route some things in a different way or something like that, and they use that national security argument. So a little bit uncomfortable with that terminology, but we can certainly say public interest, and you know, that's a real concern.
Hi, I'm Helen Yost with Wild Idaho Rising Tide. We're based in Sandpoint, Idaho, next to Idaho's largest, deepest lake, where BNSF Railway runs about 60 trains, both east and west, every day, and almost a mile over that lake. They recently constructed a second bridge. And we have been both monitoring and protesting oil, coal, and hazardous materials train traffic through that area since 2012. And we're grateful to some of our Spokane comrades who have tried to put laws in place to cut down on that train traffic. But I'm curious what your suggestions would be as workers of the railroads on how some of the environmental and community health and safety hazards could be eliminated or at least reduced by public ownership of the railroads. We're concerned, of course, about the railroads have been built, especially in the mountainous west, really close to waterways. There's a lot of pollution of those waterways by coal dust, and you know, there's the high risk of hazardous materials or oil spilling into those water bodies, and also, of course, if there's wrecks at the base of mountains of something that's flammable, it could start huge forest fires. How, you know, could public ownership perhaps move some of those rail lines or reduce the hazards of that kind of freight through communities?
Well, very quickly, the public ownership is actually the only way that we have an angle on doing something about those concerns that you have. I'll give you an example from my own work. In 2013, you all knew about the terrible, devastating wreck in the town of Lac-Mégantic in Quebec. And I headed up the international defense effort for the railroad guys that were scapegoated in that instance. And what I can tell you is, I mean, we could go on all night about this. I mean, this has become way more than an assignment for me. This is personal, but the Ed Burkhart, the U.S. run railroad that ran that train, made it so long and so heavy that it couldn't fit in any of the side. There's a, goes on and on and on. But the key thing is, they never had a fire plan. They were going to run a unit train of the most explosive, most dangerous stuff, and it never occurred to them that they should have a fire plan. Under public ownership, that wouldn't be the situation. Now, some of you all may or may not find this controversial or whatever, but I actually participated in a pretty big group of labor people that were invited by the Cuban Trade Union Federation some years ago to go down and have a tour and a visit, and I put this question to them directly. And granted, this is not necessarily any kind of thing about the models that we would necessarily use here, but you know, I'd say, let's say you had to move products like these, and they explained step by step by step how they would, like, the most important thing was that we move those things safely. Not the most important thing being, okay, well, we all have to get the next quarter profit up or the operating ratio down or the blah, blah, blah. Only about the safe movement of that stuff. So I'll just leave that at that. That's what you can do with public control.
Yes.
I have a follow-up question, if I may. Another issue we have around such a large water body is that any emissions into the air stay sort of suspended in that air under moist conditions. And most locomotives are both diesel and electric. What's the possibility of going all electric and getting rid of those carcinogenic diesel emissions to benefit both the health of workers and communities?
Well, so we have some real allies on this question, and one of them is on a call tonight, Sasha with Solutionary Rail. Solutionary Rail has been among the first and biggest and most powerful advocates for the electrification of the rails. Another example is one of our other allies, the United Electrical Workers, which is one of the most progressive unions in the country. And
yeah,
they are our partners in a sense, and that they, one of their big businesses is the building of locomotives, and they have the technology right now to help us with making this transformation. It'll be incremental, and there's different technologies that are more appropriate in one place as opposed to another. But me personally, I'm pretty much with the Solutionary Rail people on this. We can electrify right now, and if we did it, we don't have to experiment. We don't have to invent any new stuff. We can fix everything in a big way right now, and that'll help us in the transition away from those other things. And I actually have a project right here in Washington, D.C. It's now in its fourth iteration switching locomotives, which is a particular type of locomotive. Millions of dollars now we've done, and we don't go all the way to electric because we can't. It's not something that's a possibility for us. But what we've done is we've taken the worst equipment with the worst circumstances and the worst situation, you know, most dangerous to the community, most dangerous to my coworkers, and we've resolved that problem when we forced the railroad by leading in this question. And this is another RWU thing, that the unions have to lead. What the unions want to do, what the unions want to do is say the companies make all the decisions and then we'll bargain over wages and benefits. No, if we want the future, we have to lead on it, and that's what we've done with the project that we have in Washington.
Yeah, hi, this is Jeremy. This is kind of a technical question. I worked on a light rail in Sacramento, and they use pantographs, an electrical system. They use pantographs, you know, above the track, suspended wire, etc. And I'm just confused how you could convert a whole heavy-duty rail transport system to electric. So it's just kind of a technical question. Is it all already understood and able to do, are we able to do that, or would there have to be major changes to the infrastructure, rail infrastructure, to change it?
I think what we'd like to see is that at some point, and it's not ready for prime time, that we would see some other technologies like hydrogen and stuff. But there's, to answer your immediate question, you know, almost my entire operating career over the railroad was under catenary. So I'm one of the relatively, you know, we're the redheaded stepchildren of the industry of the country, but in the Northeast Corridor, we have catenary. And catenary works. It works right now. We know how to do it. Many places in the world, that's what they do. One of the things that you might really, I mean, especially on this question, that you'd want to learn more about is what the Indian government has done in India, where they have, in the course of 10 years, basically electrified their entire country. It's unbelievable what they are able to do. It's just it's a combination of using, you know, don't deciding that you have to invent some new thing when you actually have a solution at hand, and then having the political will and the power to do it. And they have done that, and their whole country is advanced for that situation. Now, I mean, I've worked in places, and I did work on the light rail side myself, and on where I worked on the light rail, we also had third rail. I'm not a big fan of third rail, but it's a thing, and you can do it. We know how to do it. So there's various technologies. I personally think that if we want to do something in the near term, overhead catenary is probably the way we need to do that.
Fritz, I missed a question in the chat. Ben asks, what is the most irresponsible part of private ownership of our railroads?
Well, that's actually sort of easy. I mean, there's lots of things. It's a big contest. But right now what it is that because the hedge funds have taken over, so they do, you've heard of stock buybacks? I don't know if everybody, you know, it's a billionaire thing, but what happens is that the railroad boards make these kinds of decisions very disingenuously. It has nothing to do with service, has nothing to do with safety, where they create a you know, they make a lot of money, and then they buy back their own stock, and what that does is that means that the hedge fund people who are on the boards take their profit and leave. And they've done this in industry after industry after industry. It's called financial strip mining. But the stock buybacks is my answer to you. The stock, you know, because what they do is they've got money, right? And so because they do this operating ratio, they sell equipment, they fire people, they deny service, and then they, instead of taking that money and using it in some way to make the railroad do the job that it's supposed to do, they only do this financial thing, this operation that goes on at the board level, where they strip mine all of the wealth. And what they do is they take healthy companies, and this has happened across all kinds of industries in the U.S., and saddle them with debt, and then they spin off and let the rotting hulk of what was once a substantial corporation twist in the wind, and they go on to the next thing. We've got this problem all across our industry. The only railroad that theoretically isn't doing that is the BNSF, and they really sort of are too. So the stock buybacks.
Just a quick question. Fritz, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Let me put my information in the chat, and then you'll have.
Great.
Be sure you get down on what he said about that strip mining, that financial operation. So the major problem is it's financial scams at the Wall Street level. I think people forget that. And I want to thank you, Fritz. This was we are cutting you. I know we're kind of
cutting it a little short, but there are a couple other things, and just hang on, and you'll learn a little about this railroad town of Spokane just for a second. Yeah, because of Wild Idaho Rising Tide, it's questions, and we should ask Solutionary Rail to be a speaker, a follow-up maybe next time. So we'll try and get the Solutionary Rail person in. I think that's a great idea. I think this whole idea of Scary Reddit Diesel. I might come back to you. I want a quick comment from you, Rich. Not yet. You can't leave. You've got to stay there. But a quick comment before you go on Eugene Debs. I forgot we have to do that. Don't leave a long answer on this. Leave a chance for other people to talk. But I've been told to that the railroads traditionally had this craft union problem, and that it was first addressed. And really, when it was first addressed, it was by Eugene Debs, and that the spirit of Eugene Debs, we think, is. We hope it's still living in the railroad traditions, and here in a town where we have a lot of Wobbly support, it's still we were a big Wobbly city. But anyhow, are you familiar with the term Eugene Debs? You're on, Fritz.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, so you know, unfortunately, Eugene Debs passed away in 1926, so nearly 100 years ago. And there isn't anybody on this call that would have been alive when he was still an active organizer. But for us, we actually have a very specific reason why we consider him to be the greatest rail trade unionist that the country has ever produced, and one of the great articulators and great leaders of social cause in general. And so... One of the things, and I actually, of course, you know, for all the decades I was working, I used to think about this. I used to think, isn't it an interesting thing that in this industry that we work in, that all of the great early socialist leaders, that the ones that ultimately resulted in the formation of the Socialist Party in the United States, were railroad workers, and thought, well, you know what? You know, there's a reason behind this. And one of those reasons, I did mention it briefly, is the American Railway Union. So all of you on this call, I'm sure know that in our history that, you know, the earliest organizations were based upon, you know, guilds and then crafts, and then eventually a lot of the folks, and this was, you know, a Wobbly thing too, people came to understand the weaknesses of the craft union organizing model, and generally it has basically the exact problems that I was telling you about in my own industry, where the different organizations are pitted against each other successfully, and so the idea of industrial organizing, and of course, you know, a little less than 100 years, the people of this country rose up and organized an awful lot on, you know, resulted in the formation of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, and then they merged and whatnot. Well, anyway, so the point is that Debs and his co-thinkers had been through the business of trying to successfully organize the railroads, and they came out of the different. He himself was with the firemen and oilers, and different other people in different capacities, and they repeatedly learned that they couldn't get the safety and the protections and the things that they needed using their current forms of craft unionism. And so they, in the world, working people were understanding industrial organizations was the superior way to organize. It's complicated. There's actually a few ways that are important for another conversation we could have, where craft unions actually have some advantages. But let's leave that aside for the moment. The fact was that the attempt of the early 26 unions to organize a American Railway Union, an industrial union of railroad workers, was ultimately crushed. And one of the lessons that the people who went through that process and that crushing came away with was yeah, you got to be great trade unionists and you got to have a great trade union strategy, but it's not enough. You have to also have a tool that you can use for a working class political program that, because actually many of these defeats that they suffered and we still suffer come in the political realm. So it was the business, and I think part of the thing here, and I, you know, people can disagree with me, but I really thought about this on the ground, was that it was the fact that all of us on the railroad had to work collectively to run the trains. In other words, you know, all the different people with the different kinds of skills and the different things, and they all had to come together and cooperate, whether they liked each other or not, in order to figure out how to get the train together and send it across the country. And it was the movement of people and things that were critical to the development of the country. It was the first national industry. So it was that model and that idea that everybody ended up in their head with, that this was a, this was common property. It may have actually belonged to, you know, Morgan or Rockefeller or somebody like that, but from the point of view of railroad workers thinking about it, it was our common property. It belonged to the country. It belonged to everyone who lived here. And that you know, it wasn't just pie in the sky. We could actually do it. We actually knew how to do it. It actually is what we do. And so I'll maybe just leave it at that because I know you don't have other time. But Debs goes through this process. You know, it's the capitalists actually that radicalize him. He starts out as a Democrat, you know, goes through, and you know, when you get defeated, even though you're doing the right work, you some people go away, but other people are like, okay, well, what did we do wrong? What can we do better? So each time you up the ante. Well, okay, so let us do industrial organizing. Let's use the strike as a weapon. Let's do, you know, these different kinds of things. And in the end, one of the things that they realize is that it's all encompassing. You can't even achieve what we need, even relatively modest goals, by having an industrial union. And we can't even have an industrial union. It has to have that political working class component, right, as well. And the young people today who are active, they've never heard of Debs. And this is one of our jobs. All of you here, I know you've talked about this before. This is one of our jobs. Debs is a guy, I mean, he could explain these things and people would say, oh, this guy was 100 years ago and look how he explained this. Talking about war, talking about, you know, race, blah, blah, blah. So it's our job to resurrect and, you know, it's our story that we get to tell.
Fritz, Robert put a question in the chat real quick. Were there any ICC regs ignored that caused East Palestine?
Well, of course, ICC is really not a thing anymore. It's the Surface Transportation Board now, but there are a couple of things. Most railroad accidents take several things to go wrong. The one that I focus on, there are two things in particular. One is that the hot journal, what's called hot box detectors, the hot journal detectors that would have identified this problem ahead of time are not federally regulated. I actually was personally kind of freaked out when I learned this. I did, you know, even with all my years, I didn't realize that they weren't federally regulated. They're basically leaving the fox in charge of the chicken coop, if you will, with that critical thing. So what you may know is that what happened in the case of the train that wrecked in East Palestine, it had axle problems on some of the equipment that they did not address, and because they didn't address them, they got hotter and hotter, and they caught fire, and it started 30-some miles out, and they went through three different detectors, which didn't pick up, and it was not just the fact of the regulation, it was also the fact that company policy had told them, don't tell the crew, don't tell the crew, you know, because the crew will stop. The crew will stop the train and figure out what's going on. So that's one. And then the other is what's part of what's called precision scheduled railroading, which is not precision, it's not schedule, and it's not railroading, but it is the operating principle of all the railroads in North America today, which is to try to drive down the operating ratio, and they want it to get it under 60. And the way that it affected in this particular case was historically, you marshal the train. In other words, if you're making up a train in a yard, you put the cars in the right places according to where they have to go, but you try to put the weight to the front of the train. And you do this for a kind of a sort of a practical physics reason, which is that if there is a problem, there's a chance that the momentum and stuff will be such that you won't have a completely disastrous situation the way that what happened in East Palestine. But in East Palestine, what they did was a different kind of marshaling. It was basically the lazy person's easiest. What they basically do is they had a huge amount of the weight at the rear of the train, which is historic bad practice. Railroaders would not have operated that way in the past, but that takes work. That takes work in the yard, and they didn't want to pay for work in the yard. So they basically ended up with a train that goes down the road, and then it derails. But, it would have derailed because of the problem with the axles, but it might not have disastrously wrecked in the way that it did if it didn't have all the weight at the back of the train, like a golf ball in a sock that you swing around your head or something, the momentum of it and the accordioning of it. So like cars are tumbling, they're tumbling forward. The heaviest weight in the train is tumbling, and it creates a much worse, you can have a derailment. Hell, derailments are actually pretty common, but they don't generally wreck everything. They don't generally, destroy communities and things like that. So there were those two things. There was the fact of the not regulated journal detectors and the marshaling. And we know for a fact the marshaling made that wreck far worse than it needed to be.
On that note, we have a lot of work to do, but not much time. Right. I it's one of my favorite events. Muffy, I loved your comments. Fritz, you were great. Everyone was really helpful. I could tell everyone was in. But we are out of time. We do cut off at a quarter after.
Yep.
We'll take your advice and look for some other speakers on this and keep coming back to this issue. I think it's really important. People can write for the Dorothy Day Labor Forum newsletter by just on many of you have send something back to us, and we'll be in touch that way too. But for now, I'd say peace and solidarity, and this is a great event.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for your interest.
Yeah, it was really good. Thank you very much.